cameras and at their workplaces, observing a moment of silence here, specifically in front of the Syrian Press Martyrs Board, because the martyrs of truth are the beacons of light that illuminate the path of justice.
Syria has sacrificed dozens of journalist martyrs on the path of truth during over 13 years of its war against the terrorism supported by the West and specifically Israel. Today, Syrian journalists affirmed their unwavering support for their Palestinian brothers in their struggle against Zionist terrorism. Syrian journalists have gathered at this symbolic place in solidarity with their Palestinian counterparts who bravely resist the Israeli aggression with their words and cameras. They have unequivocally confirmed that the truth will prevail and justice will triumph. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
On Monday, the Hague-based International Court of Justice heard the final day of submissions on the legal consequences of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories since 1967. Over the 6 days of the public hearings, 52 nations and the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, the Arab League and African Union presented their arguments to the court. The first to speak on the final day of the ICJ hearings was the Turkish representative who joined a large number of nations condemning Israel's decades-long brutal policies in the Palestinian territories. Ankara pointed the finger at those nations which won't stop supporting Tel Aviv despite 30,000 innocent people have been killed in the Gaza Strip.
Those who should need are well known. The Israeli supporters in the Security Council, it is their responsibility. Indeed, most of the international community is aware of this injustice and is trying to do something.
Palestinian representatives opened the proceedings on Monday last week by accusing Israel of having subjected Palestinians to decades of discrimination, leaving them with the choice of displacement, subjugation, or death. 2 days later, the UK asked the court not to offer an opinion at all on the legal consequences of Israel's occupation.
Unfortunately, the UK came with the political arguments, and here we are in a legal body. Unfortunately, their legal argument was very weak, and we believe that the court will dismiss it. The Israeli practices and measures and its presence in the occupied Palestinian territory is unlawful, and unlawfulness should have consequences.
This ICJ case was prompted by the UN General Assembly in December 2022, and it is different from another ICJ case filed by South Africa, which has accused Israel of genocide in Gaza. Outside the court, activists showed their support to besieged Palestinians during all days of proceedings.
There's also not an excuse for the other countries to say, well, we are not complying with this legal system that we all agreed upon.
I'm here to just show the support, to say to the whole world that the genocide should stop, and this is the only way actually to support our people in Palestine and Gaza.
The court is expected to issue its advisory opinion on Israel's occupation of the Palestinian territories within 6 months. Despite having no binding force, the court's opinions nevertheless carry great legal weight and moral authority. However, it must be said, the ICJ has no enforcement arm. Max Civili, The Hague.
Repair operations in the final stages. This is the main distribution pipeline passing through Iran's southwestern province of Charmahal and Bakhtiari, responsible for delivering natural gas to the northern provinces of Iran. Part of the main pipeline hit by two explosions on February 14. Clearly, the saboteurs had picked this remote location, hoping that it would result in delayed emergency response, leading to vast natural gas outages in the country. An obvious miscalculation, as the National Iranian Gas Company, NIGC, had its local technicians and first responders on site in less than 10 minutes. The tall flames resulting from the overnight explosion could be seen from miles away.
The explosion was immense, creating a huge fire that burned and melted everything on its way 300 meters away.
Power cables were damaged. The local electricity distribution company immediately diverted to other connected paths to prevent power outages. And within minutes, local NIGC technicians arrived.
As a result of great teamwork, we were able to contain the fire in less than 5 hours, and we completed our repair operation within 44 hours, which can be considered a record. It is important to note that our local technicians were able to quickly bring the situation under control without any help from nearby provinces. That is why there were no disruptions in gas supplies.
As a result of the NIGC's agile response, the sabotage attack did not lead to any natural gas outages.
So the pipe that was damaged by the explosion, a pipe that would carry 70 million cubic meters of natural gas in 24 hours.
The NIGC had two separate alternative options. So as a first step, technicians simply cut gas flow through this pipe, which allowed the first responders to contain the fire in less than 5 hours.
Throughout the year, we carry out several simulation exercises with different scenarios to enhance our response plans and procedures for all kinds of hazards. That is why our team is always prepared for emergencies, and in this case, they knew exactly what to do according to our crisis management plan.
With the damaged pipe replaced with a new one, everything is back to normal.
This heavily damaged 42-inch pipe that you see right behind me is part of the main pipeline that takes natural gas from the south of Iran towards the north. However, the NIGC did have a plan B, and therefore the explosion did not disrupt gas supplies.
Officials detailed that because the fire sparked in an unpopulated area, the spread of the flames was manageable for the responding firefighters. There were no casualties and only limited material damage. And since the flow of heat and cooking gas to the northern provinces was not disrupted, as far as consumers were concerned, basically nothing happened. Simply a foiled attempt, with Iranians now more confident than ever in the capabilities of NIGC technicians. Gisumish Ahmadi, Boruchen.
No picket lines over the weekend, but the strike action is on. Thousands of National Health Service junior doctors, who form half of the doctors' workforce in England, walk off the job. Their demands the same as the last time we talked to them.
Because of this erosion of pay over all this time, we've been seeing problems with staff recruitment and retention, and we've been hemorrhaging people either out of medicine completely or to other countries that are willing to recruit us and pay us basically the rates we were being paid 15 years ago. And so the message from the BMA has always been to try and get that pay back to 2008 levels.
In other words, a 35% pay rise to make up for previous below-inflation pay rises. An extra 3% on top of the average of nearly 9% received last year was being discussed before talks between the government and the BMA, the trade union for doctors, broke down in December. But the walkouts come at a cost. They're happening at a critical time of year when hospitals are especially busy dealing with the challenges of the cold season and with an NHS waiting list at a staggering 7.6 million. Over 1.3 million hospital appointments had to be rescheduled since the industrial action began over a year ago. And yet, the striking doctors continue to enjoy the support of over half of Britons.
The doctors say they're doing this to bring the government back to the negotiating table and to get it to recognize their value. They're also saying that feeling undervalued and being underpaid is pushing them to seek jobs abroad.
The BMA says 4 in 10 doctors plan to leave the NHS at the first opportunity. The government says it won't negotiate while the strikes are ongoing.
There's an overall focus on privatization, which means the health care insurance companies will be taking over many aspects of the running and resources of health. And that's led to record low wages, especially compared to a massive inflation and cost of living crisis, so that it no longer justifies the cost of training. In terms of the actual remuneration, medical students are leaving with medical school with £100,000 worth of debt, and they're not looking to pay that off for well over a decade. Whereas if they go to other countries, simply next door, Ireland or Australia, they can immediately double their wage.
The British government seems nowhere near loosening its purse strings. But the consensus is that the longer these strikes grind on, the wider the damage. Saipur is up, London.
The summit of ECOWAS leaders, which ended in Abuja, the Nigerian capital, resolved that closure of air and land borders between ECOWAS countries and Niger is to be lifted in addition to other sanctions.
No-fly zone of all commercial flights to and from Niger is to be lifted. Suspension of all commercial and financial transactions between ECOWAS member states and Niger is to be lifted. Freezing of all service transactions, including utility services, is to be lifted. Freezing of assets of the Republic of Niger in ECOWAS central banks is to be lifted.
However, the ECOWAS meeting called for the ruling authority in Niger to provide an acceptable transition timetable to constitutional order. The ECOWAS leader said the decision to lift the sanctions was based on humanitarian considerations, especially as people are in the month of Lent and the holy month of Ramadan approaches. The meeting asked the three countries that exited the ECOWAS, that are Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mali, to reconsider the decisions in view of the benefits the countries and their citizens enjoy in the regional bloc, especially the hundreds of millions of dollars of projects and programs, notably the Food Security Reserve. The ECOWAS leaders therefore urged the three member states that exited the regional body to resort to dialogue, negotiation and mediation to address their concerns.
The authority has also instructed the president of the commission to invite Burkina Faso, Niger, Mali and Guinea to attend technical and consultative meetings of ECOWAS, as well as all security-related meetings.
The three West African countries exited the ECOWAS and established what they called the Sahel Alliance after ECOWAS resolved to condemn the military coups in the three countries and to impose sanctions on them. Experts believe that there are solutions in the medium and long terms for solving the crisis in the regional economic body.
The issues I mentioned earlier of pan-Africanism, of resource nationalism, of ensuring that people are carried along in decision-making processes, of ensuring that there is equitable distribution of resources, of ensuring that people have access to the good things of life, of ensuring that the dividends of governance is brought to the people, must be addressed.
As one of the least developed regions in the world, the Sahel faces a multitude of challenges, including poverty, food security, poor governance and insecurity. Experts say some of these challenges are a matter of great concern, not just for the Sahel, but for the whole of Africa and beyond. They also noted that skillful diplomacy must be employed in addressing the exit of the three West African regions from the ECOWAS. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
Iran Zamzam's company is poised to replace two major international soft drink brands in the region, driven by a growing boycott sentiment against Israeli army-associated products following the Gaza conflict. Having already entered markets in Kuwait, Bahrain, Qatar, and the UAE, the company aims to export 4 million cans of its popular soda to Kuwait, making a significant milestone in its expansion efforts.
My concept revolved around organizing a festival exclusively showcasing Iranian products. However, following the conflict in Gaza and the overwhelming positive feedback we received, we expanded our vision to encompass Turkish and Kuwaiti products as well. The event is spanned 2 months, during which we received numerous requests for an extension. Our primary objective at the society remains to spotlight Iranian, Kuwaiti, and Turkish goods, particularly as consumers are actively seeking alternatives to products associated with Israel.
Zamzam's growth in the Persian Gulf soft drink market is reinforced by its official replacement status for soda drinks in Kuwait alongside local brands like LC and Kenzo. The Iranian Turkish festival organized by the biggest societies in Kuwait, Al Jabriya, has been instrumental in promoting Zamzam and other locally made alternatives as primary substitutes for boycotted products, significantly boosting Zamzam's popularity and market presence in Kuwait.
We're also operating as a retail seller, catering to the demand for products from Iran, Turkey, and Kuwait, which many customers have been requesting. While we understand that implementing boycotts can be challenging to achieve rapidly, it's not unattainable. Therefore, in response to the tragic events in Gaza, we've completely redirected our focus towards promoting locally made products through a campaign titled Support Us Twice. The response has been phenomenal, with our sales soaring. Moreover, numerous other societies in Kuwait have chosen to follow suit and advocate exclusively for Iranian, Turkish, and locally produced goods.
The shift in consumer preference toward locally produced alternatives like Zamzam is emblematic of the broader economic repercussions of the conflict in Gaza. Major multinational corporations, including Starbucks, McDonald's, and Pepsi Cola, have experienced a significant decline in sales as consumers increasingly opt for products that align with their values and principles. As Zamzam continues to expand its footprint in the GCC countries, particularly in Kuwait, there is a shift in consumer behavior toward more regional products, and particularly the one from Iran, from other GCC countries, which is why the public in Kuwait is shifting into buying more products that are not associated in any way possible with the United States or Britain. This is Farah Al-Hashim, Kuwait City, from Al Jabriya area.
In the limelight.
The British Army has come under scrutiny for its inability to hire people at all levels of service. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Telegraph has covered this story and tells us more. A leaked document revealed the British Army wants to relax security checks it runs on overseas recruits in an effort to solve the growing staffing crisis. Understood to be the latest guidance, the internal policy document leaked to the British Daily outlines a series of actions that aim to boost falling personnel numbers and cause security clearance the primary barrier to non-UK personnel gaining a commission in the army. Vetting is a standard part of the process of becoming an officer in the British Army and included counter-terrorism checks. Security clearance is described as being the most common type of vetting process and determines that a person's character and personal circumstances are such that they can be trusted to work in a position that involves long-term, frequent, and uncontrolled access to secret assets. The 5-year period being a UK resident needed to gain security clearance was described as prohibitive to overseas recruits applying for officer and intelligence roles. The leaked document noted that the Army struggles to attract talent from ethnic minority backgrounds into the officer corps. It said that while people from Commonwealth countries can serve in the British Army, just 135 officers from overseas are currently serving in the British Armed Forces. These just 28 are recorded as being from ethnic minority backgrounds, while the rest are white Irish or white Commonwealth. A group of former army officials have since signed a letter to the UK's Defence Minister, Grant Shapps, calling the updated policy dangerous madness. The army has come under scrutiny for its inability to hire people at all levels of service. Outsourcing giant Capita, which is in charge of recruitment for the army, recommended that it should ditch or loosen restrictions on hiring soldiers with tattoos and those with a history of asthma to solve its recruitment crisis. The firm told the Defence Select Committee inquiry into the recruitment of youngsters that many were waiting 150 days to join the army, partly caused by the medical assessments they have to undertake. Its representatives told MPs that would-be recruits were being attracted elsewhere as the time taken to be accepted was so long that they were finding other jobs in the meantime, amid ominous warnings that the Army, Navy and Marines are all hemorrhaging troops faster than they can be recruited. A top US general also warned that the UK's shrinking army is not what it used to be. A former senior US general has said that while the United Kingdom was still seen as America's closest ally, it was also seen as having diminished capabilities over the past couple of decades. They added, "Hence, while being the most important ally across the board, it is decidedly not what it used to be, regrettably. Based on the current trends, the army will have just 52,000 troops in 10 years' time." In a one-year period up to September of last year, the army's strength plummeted from 79,139 to 75,983, as more soldiers left than started. The website The Defence Post has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to government figures, almost 30,000 British troops from across the armed forces are medically unfit for combat operations due to physical injuries and mental health issues. The problem is greatest in the army, where only 53,000 troops out of a total of around 75,000 personnel are currently fully fit for frontline operations. That means that 30% of all troops in the army, or 3 in 10 soldiers, would not be fully fit to fight in a conflict now. The injury crisis will heap further pressure on the new Defence Secretary Grant Shapps, following the disclosure that all 3 services are significantly under strength. According to numbers released by the Ministry of Defence, the MOD, overall, 28,664 personnel across all 3 of the armed forces are currently not fully fit for combat. While some of those could deploy overseas in an emergency as part of a large force, many would not be able to take part in combat missions or even leave a secure base because they have been medically downgraded. Recently, the Defence Post revealed the recruitment crisis is forcing the Royal Navy to decommission 2 warships, Westminster and Argyll, so that the new class of Type 26 frigates can be staffed. According to the Ministry of Defence, the army is currently composed of around 74,110 personnel, but only 53,192 are fit for operations, or what the military calls medically fully deployable. A Freedom of Information document obtained by this newspaper reveals that 9,217 soldiers are classified as medically limited deployable, meaning that they can deploy on operations but will only be able to conduct certain duties. A further 7,449, almost 1 in 10 of all soldiers, cannot be deployed at all and are classified as medically non-deployable. Comparisons with the number of injured troops from July of 2021 appear to show that the problem is getting worse. In July of 2021, there were 13,248 troops across the armed forces classified as non-deployable. But by July of 2023, the latest figures available show that the number had grown to 14,743. Further, 7,921 personnel were classed as being of limited deployability. The classification means that they have either a persistent but relatively minor injury, such as a back problem, or an injury that is close to recovery, such as ligament damage. According to government figures, there are 29,220 personnel serving in the Royal Navy and Royal Marines, while a further 29,010 personnel serving in the Royal Air Force. But Ministry of Defence figures show that there are currently just 21,649 fully fit sailors in the Navy, while the Royal Air Force has just 19,466 fit personnel. The Freedom of Information request reveals that across the armed forces, 13,727 troops have been downgraded from frontline duties because of musculoskeletal injuries suffered in training or from combat. But the document also shows 4,214 troops cannot deploy on combat operations because of mental health problems. Meanwhile, the number of troops being treated for orthopedic and spinal injuries under the National Health Service Fast Track Surgery contract has more than doubled in the last 4 years. In 2020-2021, 203 were treated under the scheme, but in 2023-2024, the Ministry of Defence predicts up to 540 personnel will receive fast-track treatment. The recruitment crisis facing the armed forces led Grant Shapps to decide to mothball the amphibious assault ships Albion and Bulwark. It has since emerged that the Royal Marines are currently 600 troops short of their target figure, and the Army and the Royal Navy are also short of personnel, amid claims that the so-called Generation Z is unwilling to join up. According to new figures, Army recruitment has been below target every year for more than a decade. Data uncovered by Labour Party shows that the recruiters signed up 5,560 regular soldiers last year when their target was 8,220, leaving a gap of 2,660 personnel. In the worst performing year of 2018-2019, there was a deficit of 4,130 troops, with 5,860 soldiers recruited when the army needed as much as 9,990 soldiers.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
as well as target an aerial surveillance base in the Upper Galilee region with 40 rockets, and this target being deeper inside the occupied territories this time. The attack was in response to the Monday Israeli strike on the Lebanese city of Baalbek that left two civilians dead. The resistance group has also shot down an Israeli drone over southern Lebanon. Hezbollah and Israel have been engaged in clashes since the Israeli regime launched its genocidal war on Gaza in early October. Meantime, truce talks are also ongoing in the Qatari capital over the genocidal war on Gaza. So what's the future holding for Gaza? Where is the Hezbollah-Israeli conflict heading for? Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi, and these are our guests in this edition of the program. Elijah Magni, your journalist and political analyst, is joining us from Brussels. Also with us will be Merhaba Osman, journalist, political analyst, and host of Press TV's mainstream program out of Beirut.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let me welcome both my guests to the show, beginning with Elijah. This genocidal war that the Israeli regime has waged, Elijah, on Gaza, has impacted the region. It has kind of spread. You know that resistance fighters have not been sitting idle by. They have been performing their own retaliatory operations. Now, we're talking about the Hezbollah in this episode more. Hezbollah is one of them, and it seems that some analysts maintain that even if the war in Gaza stops, the tension between Tel Aviv and Hezbollah could linger on. Do you agree with that? And if so, where could that end up in?
Thank you for having me.
Sure.
I'm not sure that Israel can afford to see the war continuing on the Lebanese borders because of the Hezbollah capability that has manifested in the last 4.5 months. And we have seen how Hezbollah gradually used sophisticated missiles, drones, heavy rockets, and proved the capability of selecting specific and precise military targets all along the 100 to 110 kilometers all along the Lebanese borders. Moreover, we have seen also drones going more than 90 kilometers inside Palestine, bypassing even Haifa. And we have seen how the Hezbollah bombarded the Golan Heights, Safad, and other targets, showing that it can keep up with the Israeli challenge. However, what has been introduced recently was the anti-air missiles that drove the Israeli totally out of their balance when the drone, the Hermes 450, that can fly up to 20,000 feet, was downed by the Hezbollah anti-air unit. Right. This is why Hezbollah is showing its military capability and is hiding even much more. The Hezbollah started the war, and Hezbollah is saying that is ready to shed. Israelis are only saying that they will continue if the diplomatic mediation has failed or will fail in convincing Hezbollah to stop the war. Therefore, it is always conditioned with an element that the Israelis are making sure they offer it to the audience that they really don't want to engage in all-out war immediately and have only this option even if they have instructed their people that the war will last until the beginning of the month of August.
Okay. Now, Marwa, of course, there is this division among the Israeli officials. We know about that. And we have some radical one, of like the Israeli war minister, Yoav Gallant, saying that there will be no decline, in his words, in Israeli action against Hezbollah, even if the ceasefire is agreed upon in Gaza. And we'll talk about the ceasefire later in the show. So do you share the same view as Elijah?
I share nothing as Elijah, and Elijah knows very well why I share nothing as Elijah. I didn't know that he will be here. If I knew that he will be here, I wouldn't have accepted the invitation. But anyhow, since I am the daughter of Press TV and a worker at Press TV at the same time, and being as a guest today, not as part of Press TV, I'll continue out of respect for the producer who had me here but did not tell me that this will be the second guest. And as you know, Behrouz, I cannot just stay calm about anything in my life. And this is one of the stances that I should say, that apparently your second guest now finds it possible to be on Press TV after years of being very critical against Hezbollah, Press TV, the Axis of Resistance. I'm really surprised he's here. Anyways, talking
stick
about...
to the point, please.
Yeah, I will get to the point. Talking about what is happening, especially what Yoav Gallant said, I think you've heard Yoav Gallant say the same thing in the first ceasefire that was announced in the war on Gaza. I think it was the first after the first month and a half. And I think that it was not necessarily a message towards his own people as much as it was some sort of a message towards the internal Lebanese society, by trying to threaten them not to go back to their houses in the event that there was a ceasefire announced, because even if a ceasefire gets hold of Lebanon as well after it gets hold of Gaza, the Zionist Israeli settlers will not go back to their settlements. And the reason why is that they have made it clear that they will not go back even if a ceasefire is made with Lebanon, because they don't feel safe. This is what they are saying. So Yoav Gallant is trying somehow to keep also the Lebanese border out of, keeping the Lebanese people out of the Lebanese border as well, because he knows very well, even if the ceasefire takes place, the Israeli settlers are not going back. They are demanding a conclusive truce, some sort of a peace plan with Lebanon, or else they will not return. And we have heard a lot of issues being discussed about this matter, over the fact that there are some political people being sent to intermediate in Lebanon, especially from the United States of America, telling Hezbollah that there might be some sort of a political solution that they might reach with the Zionist entity, a political one rather than a military one. And Hezbollah said that, repeats what they keep saying, repeats what we heard Said Hassan Nasrallah say since the beginning of the war on Gaza up until now, that Hezbollah will stop when the war on Gaza stops. And Said Hassan Nasrallah, in his last speech, he made it clear that in the event of a ceasefire in Gaza, Hezbollah will stop fire. But if the Zionist entity continues to fire, Hezbollah will fire equally in a deterrent manner, the same manner that we have been seeing. Yes, it has been escalating, but at a very, very slow pace. But at the end of the day, it is being confined to certain areas, to certain targets, and not getting involved, for example, with the capital or with major residential areas, despite the fact that Zionist Israel always bombards residential areas and claims that it is targeting Hezbollah depots, when in reality, and after the Lebanese authorities investigate, they find that they are either privately owned companies or residential areas where literal Lebanese civilians were just living with their families there.
Okay. Now, Elijah, Lebanese resistance fighters, they have mainly targeted Israeli military positions, but you see that the Israeli regime has targeted residential areas in Lebanon and causing the death of a number of civilians there. So it's not only the Gaza Strip that you see this. Tel Aviv's disregard is everywhere for civilian lives, no matter where. Now you see this also noticeable in Lebanon.
Because Israelis are careless about civilian lives, we have seen how little importance they give to the Geneva Convention, and to the international laws in Gaza. They have done that in the past against Lebanon, in the many previous wars. This is why it is not surprising when we see the Israelis trying to target the Lebanese civilians and trying to drag Hezbollah into a wider war. This is something that Hezbollah is very conscientious about, and this is why Hezbollah is limiting always the fight and the war in support of Gaza, so the Palestinian cause is always in the center of attention, and bringing back the Israelis to the same rules of engagement and imposing deterrence on the Israelis, even if sometimes what the Israelis do is quite painful when they kill civilians that are supposed to be spared. But at the end of the day, the world is dealing with the most immoral army in the world, and we have seen how the Israelis are behaving, have behaved in the past, and are behaving today in Palestine. So I am not surprised to see this behavior of the Israelis and trying always to hit those who are the weakest in any war.
Right. And Marwa, lots of people have been displaced from both sides of the border, especially from the Israeli side. Thousands of people have been displaced in this exchange of fire between the two sides, Hezbollah and the IOF. And I remember Hezbollah chief warning the Tel Aviv regime just recently, maybe a couple of weeks back, that if they take further steps and if they move toward further escalation, Hezbollah will do something so that the, you know, Israelis have to be actually forced to evacuate maybe 2 million Israelis close to the border. So I want to ask you, would you expect this in any way to turn into a full-fledged war? And if that happens, who would be the loser at the end of the day?
Beirut, I think the only option that this might end up being a full-fledged war is directly related to the preliminary results of the U.S. elections. It has nothing to do whatsoever with what the Israelis want or can do, because if it's only about the Israeli capability, it is definitely a no. The answer to your question would be a no. But we have to look at it from a wider angle. If the Biden administration is not going to be able to stop Donald Trump from returning to power, I think the U.S. might go ahead and, in order to try and use Code 606 for their own country, which means stopping the elections because of a major war that might take place that would end up having the United States of America get involved, then yes, the answer to your question would be yes. But at the moment, reading what's happening, looking at the regional politics, the international politics, and the U.S. politics, and also diving into the internal Israeli politics, when you see how the protests against Netanyahu and the war cabinet in general is escalating, people are going back to the streets, same as they did before the war, because if you remember, they were in the streets for like 54 to 56 weeks trying to get rid of the Netanyahu government because of the reform plan that they wanted to impose on their judicial system. Now we are seeing a return to the protests, not with the same intensity, but it is being said that in the event that a ceasefire happens, we will see protests in the streets the same way we did before. So that's a more pressure on the Israeli government to stop the war. So if it is only according to the variables that are found inside of the Israeli entity, the answer is definitely not.
Okay. Now, Elijah, let's now take a glance at the situation in the Gaza Strip and related developments there. Qatari Foreign Ministry spokesman Majid Al-Ansari says that Doha is optimistic that a deal on a ceasefire will be achieved before Ramadan. And also we have U.S. President Joe Biden hoping that this will happen by next Monday. But Hamas, speaking of some big gaps to be bridged before a deal is reached, is a deal around the corner, in your opinion?
I think the ceasefire is something that everybody wants at the moment. But what Benjamin Netanyahu is trying to do is to bring a goat in the farm at the last moment. Because he feels in a strong position, and he feels by starving the population, by continuing the bombardment in Gaza, even if he has not achieved any of the declared objectives at the beginning of the war, He can twist the arms of the Palestinian resistance because he doesn't care about the 136 Israeli prisoners. So what he's trying to do is he's trying to accommodate the American pressure, at the same time the families of the prisoners, by releasing a small number. There have been a talk about 40 prisoners to be released in exchange of a certain number of Palestinian prisoners that has not been agreed upon yet. But at the same time, it is important to keep the Muslims away from fighting during the month of Ramadan. That will end also by the beginning of the Jewish feast that would last for 7 days on the 22nd of April. So this kind of combination, it is suitable for the Israelis and for the Palestinians to breathe a little bit and to have less bombardment on a daily basis against the civilians, allow the civilians to go and see what happened to their beloved one, or if they can find something still standing, or perhaps have more humanitarian aid, because the Israel has been violating the ICJ order and the international laws and committing war crimes and crimes against humanity by denying the population the basic service, a basic need to survive, and denying them water, food, and electricity. So for that, I think the problem are the details of the deal. And Netanyahu is trying to squeeze as much as possible to give less concession and to offer himself as a good negotiator to his people, and at the same time plan to continue the war on Gaza after the ceasefire.
Now, Marwan, you know that Netanyahu has also threatened to launch this military assault on Rafah, and you know what the situation is in Rafah like. More than a million Palestinians have been forced into displacement there, and some of them are being starved to death, another weapon that, unfortunately, Israel is using, apart from all those, you know, U.S.-made weapons and all that that they are using against them. They're also being starved to death, dying of some preventable diseases. So Netanyahu is just saying that the attack on Rafah will happen, definitely, that's for sure, and a possible ceasefire deal would only postpone it. So let's have your assessment of the situation.
I think that he means it, and I think that the Biden administration, despite the fact that they keep saying that they don't like it, they would see a catastrophe coming out of it, or that they have many times asked the Israeli entity not to harm any civilians while the Rafah operation is underway. They did not tell the Israeli entity they're not allowed to initiate any sort of ground invasion or air invasion against Rafah, which means that the United States of America actually gave the green light for such a horrific operation that might end up in a second phase of the genocide that we witnessed before, and we are still witnessing massacres that come out of this genocide. So I think that if there is something that would stop Netanyahu, it would have to be some sort of internal pressure or elevated resistance coming from Palestine, in specific, and the axis of resistance by default. But if Netanyahu is to break that ceasefire, which is also a possibility, because we saw how the first part of the Paris talks just went down the drain because Netanyahu felt like it and decided that he wants to finish off with Khan Yunis and probably start something in Rafah, but was then stopped by the Americans for the sole purpose of approaching Ramadan and what Ramadan means, the holy month of Ramadan means for all Muslims, and especially the Muslims of Palestine who would go and pray in Al-Aqsa, and not allowing them or continuing the genocide during the month would only elevate and escalate the situation against the entire axis of resistance. But in case Netanyahu decides to break the ceasefire or wait until the ceasefire, which is supposedly, according to certain sources coming from Egypt and Qatar, that it would be around 45 to 50 days, if he's going to wait 45 to 50 days and then relaunch that attack on Rafah, I think the first thing that he would be doing is pushing the current displaced people, the refugees in Rafah, either to Gaza or northern than that, but under the condition that he's been stating several times right now, whether in the Zionist media or elsewhere, that he will not allow men to go with the women and the children and the elderly. So I think what we saw in the northern part of Gaza, where the Israeli entity occupation forces entered forcefully with Merkava and whatnot to basically just incarcerate everyone there, including the paramedics and the doctors and the nurses and everyone involved in helping, directly helping the civilians, will happen again in Rafah, and he might take advantage of this 40 to 50 days truce to maybe let off some of the civilians who will either accept going back to the north under certain conditions or completely leaving into the Sinai desert. And either way, it's a catastrophe. Okay. It's a second Nakba for the Palestinian people.
Okay, Elijah, how do you look at this? What's going to become of Rafah?
I don't think the Israelis can afford not to occupy Rafah, because Benjamin Netanyahu have said already that he has still four Hamas battalions to deal with in the area of Rafah. However, he needs to look after the 1979 Camp David agreement with the Egyptians, because he's not allowed to put more than four battalions on the borders with Egypt. That will require a lot of effort, international effort, and pressure from the Americans. Nevertheless, the resistance can never be defeated, because we have seen how he claimed to have occupied the north and occupied the middle, but occupying is something and controlling something else. The resistance is still bombarding the Israeli settlement from the north. The Israelis are still bombing the north with artillery and airplane, which means that there is a still significant resistance in the north, and he is still engaged in Khan Yunis. Therefore, everything he's saying is just to keep the battle as long as possible, allowing him to sort out his domestic affairs and make sure that there is no strong appetite for a very early election, where he is going to be accountable for all the mistakes that he did, according to the Israeli society, on the 7th of October, and also the corruption charges. Therefore, it is not a promenade that he's going to go to Rafah, because the Palestinian resistance is still strong. Moreover, the international community, although they are finding excuses for Israel, saying you need to displace 1.5 million internally displaced Palestinians from Rafah, it is not that easy to send an army operating on the ground with so many civilians around, even if he doesn't care a lot about civilians. So between what he's saying and what he can do, there is still a huge gap